have a confession to make. I was going to prepare my talk yesterday, and I didn't. I've never been in the maelstrom of a news story before. It's really quite an experience. I don't want to talk about that particularly, but if anybody's interested, I mean, it was really kind of cool. Second confession. I assumed I would be talking about touchscreen machines. That's what happens with being a geek and having your computer with you. So I was going to talk about touchscreen machines, but I thought maybe I'd talk about internet voting because that's really kind of fresh in my mind. But how do you feel about that? What would you prefer? Any preference? Either or? You don't care? Both? Oh, 20 minutes. Okay, that's a challenge. I also thought I just grabbed today's San Jose Mercury News. There was an even better one a few days ago where the whole front page was on voting. This one, it's just the top article, securing electronic voting, and then if you turn to the inside where it's continued, it says it's securing voting, and they managed to find some space for the information about the Pentagon project being killed there too. So it's getting a lot of press in where I live, in Silicon Valley. I should mention that I am from California, and usually when I mention that about talking about voting and I refer to our recall election, at least in Germany, they thought that was funny. All right, you want me to talk about both? Well, first I want to give a plug for our report. That much I'm going to do if I don't get to it. So let me just tell you what happened with the internet voting. There are four computer scientists, Avi Rubin, David Wagner, David Jefferson, and myself were among a group of people who were invited in to examine the security issues for CERV, the DOD's internet voting project. We were the only four who participated in both meetings. Some of the press releases from the Pentagon said there were 10, but the 10 included two social scientists who had a contract from DOD to do a study of the election. In fact, there were only a total of 8 technical people altogether. Anyway, we four wrote this report. And it was almost as interesting when the report was first released, because we got a lot of press for that, too. It was in the New York Times and the Washington Post, and we got a lot of... That was kind of fun, too. But we actually did think we might kill it, but I think at some level we never believed that we were going to do that. So it was really quite extraordinary. You can find the report, the original report, on our website, www.servsecurityreport.org. And if you don't remember, I can tell you afterwards. It's not very long. It's about 34 pages long. And even if you're not a technical person, the executive summary and the intro are very easy to read. So I usually like to start off with a couple of quotes. So who said this? Those who cast the votes decide nothing. Those who count the votes decide everything. Right. Okay, now who said the next one? Stalin, Joseph Stalin. Those who count the votes decide everything. We always pray for large margins. Not quite as famous. That was Teresa Lepore of butterfly ballot fame. That has to do with the whole issue of doing recounts. Just a comment. We seem to be moving in this country to a situation where you can't do recounts, which can be a bit disturbing if you think, for example, there might be a problem with the election. So one question is, why is this an issue now? And obviously Florida in 2000 and 2002 had a lot to do with it. And I think one of the most unfortunate things is that people drew the wrong conclusions from the punch card ballot debacle. A number of organizations, unfortunately, like the League of Women Voters and it seems maybe the ACLU, are claiming that you can't count paper. Now, I don't think any banker would accept that notion. I don't think any racetrack people would accept that notion. We deal with paper all the time. We count it very well, thank you. But for some reason, because people had trouble with these punch card ballots, they think you can't count paper. One of the things that happened in Florida, which most people don't know about, is that a lot of the Chad trays weren't emptied. So when people tried to punch through, they had real problems. We've been using punch card machines in Palo Alto for years and never had any difficulties. I don't particularly like them. I mean, I think that there are better techniques than punch card, than some of these punch card ballots where you can't look at it afterwards and make sure you voted for the right person. Although there are some are better than others. But be that as it may, the lesson that you can't count paper is the very wrong lesson to take. Now, in California, we've had some interesting things happen aside from our recall election. We have a Secretary of State who has come out with a mandate that all electronic voting machines in California are going to have voter-verified audit trails for new machines for new machines by 2005 and for currently already purchased machines by 2006. Unfortunately, we're going to have a big election in between, so we still have to worry about what happens in those elections. One of the things that a number of us are suggesting to people is that if you vote on these touchscreen machines, if you have to vote on them, get an absentee ballot. At least you have a paper ballot. There are problems with absentee ballots, too, which we could get into about the whole issue of possibility of coercion or selling your votes, but at least there is a paper trail. Now, there's another reason why this has become an issue, and that is something called the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA. HAVA provides almost $4 billion for new voting machines. It was passed after the 2002 subsequent debacle in Florida. I think a lot of reformers or people who had the idea of reforming felt that we just had to go out and replace these punch card machines with new modern machines and everything would be okay. That's one issue. Another issue is that it basically created a gold rush kind of thing, gold rush kind of situation. So you had these companies going out and producing these machines with inadequate testing, with inadequate staff, and with no standards, no reasonable standards. And we had election officials looking at them and saying, well, these are really cool because, you know, they got the nice touch screens and they're easy to use and there's no paper. You don't have to worry about paper. You don't have to worry about printing ballots. Just, you know, so much easier. And, you know, you don't have to have a recount. Basically what happened was things were sort of moving along all right until I think David Dill is one of the people one has to give credit for really making this into a national issue. David Dill is a computer science professor at Stanford, and he had just started a petition, which you can find on his website. Voterverified.org. Verified voting. Sorry. Thank you. Verifiedvoting.org. Calling for voter-verified audit trails for all voting machines. He had just started on that when he discovered, to his horror, that Silicon Valley, which is where Stanford is, which is where I live, that basically San Mateo County was about to purchase some of these touchscreen machines. And so I met David when the two of us went together to lobby. Well, that's the wrong word. I don't lobby. To educate one of the members of the Board of Supervisors of Santa Clara County about the risks. Now, this is a very nice gentleman. There was a document this thick, I swear, this thick, produced by the staff of the election officials on the various machines. They did all kinds of testing. They asked people how they liked them. They had, what are these groups called when you get people's opinions? Like in focus groups. Oh, they had focus groups on anything you can think of. Lots and lots of focus groups, lots and lots of feedback. They're worried about how easy they are to use. Do people like them? Do they feel comfortable with them? And so on and so forth. Now, Silicon Valley has some major universities in it. They've got some world-renowned computer scientists there. None of the computer science community was consulted on this. And when David found out about this and sent out an SOS, it was almost a done deal. There were three, they had already decided they were going to get these paperless touchscreen machines called DRE, Direct Recording Electronic, and they had narrowed it down to three contestants, Diebold, ES&S, and Sequoia, who are the big three. And they were leaning towards Sequoia. So when we went in to talk to one of the supervisors, we started talking about the security issues. It had never dawned on him. It had never dawned on the officials. I mean, I really think they thought they were doing the right thing, being very conscientious. They did all these focus groups. Everybody liked it. They were happy. You know, the question was which one to buy, and everything was going to be great. And all of a sudden, these computer scientists come along and say, whoa, it's not okay. you really have to be worried. You can't necessarily know that these things are going to work right. So it was an interesting experience. We ended up going to boards of supervisor meetings and sitting through 3 hours of meetings so that we can each get 1 minute to speak. One of the problems I think we've had has been getting our voices heard, although I think we're getting better at that. Oh, I should also mention with the HAVA bill, going back to that, you can see I'm sort of winging it here. In addition to the gold rush mentality, there's a requirement that people with disabilities be able to vote unaided. Now, this is something which I think is important. I think it's a very good thing. But the problem is that a lot of voting officials have interpreted this to mean that you have to go out and get these DREs with headphones attached so that blind people can vote unaided. As I say, they talk about disabilities, but they really mean blind or vision impaired. And there's also been a significant effort by some members of the blind community to lobby for these paperless touchscreen machines. Now, there are other ways of making it possible for people with vision problems to vote unaided. One way, for example, is to have a touchscreen machine which does not count your vote at all, but simply marks a ballot like an optical scan ballot. You can still have all the advantages of the earphones. You can put the optical scan ballot through an optical scan reader with earphones so you can validate it that way. Admittedly, there could still be problems, but this is something which is easier to test, because sighted people can try it too. So then there are other ways one can do this, but the lesson that people were taking was that you had to use these paperless touchscreen machines, and what's been especially frustrating for us has been that there are leaders of this community who have been attacking the efforts to require voter-verified paper ballots on the grounds that it discriminates against blind people. Now, I think this argument makes about as much sense as arguing that if you have fire escapes on buildings, it discriminates against people who are in wheelchairs, and therefore you shouldn't have fire escapes. It's a similar kind of situation where everybody benefits from having the ballots verified. It makes it harder to have fraud. It makes it harder for bugs in the software to go unnoticed. And, in fact, there was a federal decision which said that this does not discriminate against blind people, but nonetheless, one of the major forces that's fighting the effort to have voter-verified paper ballots have been elements in the blind community, which is really unfortunate because the fact is that we could have it all. We could have it all. We could have voter-verified paper ballots and have independent voting by blind people. That's possible. So let's see, what else? I'm sure you've all heard about the scandals with Diebold. I don't know if I need to go into that. No, actually, let Bev talk about that. That's her specialty. I'll give that one to Bev. Let me talk briefly about some of the issues with DREs. One of the problems is that the code is secret. Now, when you think about this, we are being asked to vote on computers that are run and controlled by private corporations with secret code. It actually can be a federal felony for a computer scientist to look at the code to try to decompile the code or to break the encryption that might be protecting it, if there is any, which there usually isn't, under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. So people are actually worried that they might be found guilty of a federal felony if they go in and look at the code on some of these machines. And Bev will tell you how Diebold got stuck with having that happen anyway. But in general, Diebold is sort of like the poster child for all the things that are wrong with DREs, but many of us feel that we know about Diebold just because they screwed up so badly, but there's no reason to believe that the other machines are particularly better. So that's one problem. It's secret code. Now, one answer that people sometimes have to the secret code is they'll talk about open or public source code. I think open is a dangerous word to use because in computer science that means you get to change it too. So I prefer to use public, making the source code public. I think that's a good thing to do, but it doesn't necessarily solve the problem. And there are two reasons why it doesn't solve the problem. One is, as we all know, software is buggy. Certainly if you write large, complex programs, it's buggy. And simply making it public won't prevent the code from containing bugs. People will find them. Some people will find some bugs because it's public, but that doesn't mean that it's bug-free, as we all know. Secondly, it's possible, if you really want to do it, to hide malicious code and make it very difficult to find. There was a recent incident with Linux where there was an attempt to put malicious code in. It was found, but it was sort of a fluke that it was found because, in some sense, Linux is, well, I mean, it was being done right. But even so, it was lucky that it was found, and it was a case of one equal sign versus two equal signs. And that's how subtle it was. So these things can be extremely subtle. If you've got a huge amount of code, you don't know exactly where things are going, you don't necessarily follow all the logic, it can be pretty easy to hide malicious code in that software. So even if it's public source, that doesn't guarantee you'll find it. Then, of course, that doesn't get into the issue talking about computer science kinds of stuff. You could actually have you can have the software perfect and have a compiler which is malicious and makes changes. So there are all kinds of risks that one runs with the software. So that's a second issue. Then, of course, there's this problem that you don't have any kind of backup if there's any problem. And I have a whole list of horror stories I could tell you, but I know that that's also an area which Bev excels. So maybe I'll leave Bev to tell the horror stories. There's some real good ones. Let me also mention, I'd like to talk a little bit about revolving doors, because that's another issue. One problem is that election officials and vendors tend to have fairly symbiotic relationships. In general, because election officials like to get the help of the vendors, so that's understandable. But we also have the situation where you can have people leaving election official jobs and going to work for vendors, and there are lots of examples of that. I'll just mention a few. In California, Lou Dedier, who was the former California Deputy Secretary of State and was in charge of dealing with voting technology, went to work for ES&S. And then, of course, there's the story of Chuck Hagel, who was elected from Nebraska in 1996 and again in 2002, the first time a lot of the machines were, I believe they were optical scanned from a company that he owned. That company was subsequently purchased by ES&S, where he's now a major stockholder, and ES&S machines were used extensively in Nebraska. And he didn't even mention that on his disclosure statements, and I think Bev is the person who uncovered that, right? The Hagel thing, didn't you find that?
Yeah.
Right. Sequoia is a British-owned corporate parent is Madison Dearborn, which is a partner of the Carlyle Group, and there have been some cases where there have been some Sequoia executives who were indicted in a corruption case in Louisiana, and I'm proud to say that it is Sequoia machines, which we now have in Palo Alto. By the way, are there any touchscreen machines around here? Yeah, what kind do you have? You got Sequoia too? Oh, right. What? So here's a cute trick, and this works for all of these machines. Have you ever voted for like the first candidate and the fifth candidate at the same time? Have you ever tried that? What do you think happens if you do that, if you push them both simultaneously? Guess. Huh? The one in the middle. It takes three. Yeah, that's what it does. That's what it does. I actually tried it on because I voted in the recount. I figured I should use these machines at least once, and I tried it. And yeah, sure, that's what it does. Yeah. So I don't know what it does if there's not one in the middle. I don't know if it takes, you know, if it's 1, 2, 3, 4, if it takes two or it takes three. And that's a function of the technology, of the kind of touchscreen technology that it's not actually. The reason they're all the same is they all use the same technology. Okay, I'll just mention a little bit about Diebolds. I say Bev will go into greater detail about that, but many of you heard the quote from Walter Odell, who is the CEO of Diebold, who is a strong Bush supporter. Diebold is located in Ohio, and he was quoted as saying that he was committed to helping Ohio deliver its electoral votes to the president next year. He said this in a fundraising letter that went out to large corporate givers. This bothered a few people. especially because Diebold machines are widely used, by the way. That was what was purchased in Maryland, and I'm sure you've been hearing a lot about the Maryland situation with Diebold. There was a study that just came out a few days ago about that, where some white hat hackers were able to hack into Diebold machines, basically verifying some work that was done by a group of computer scientists, sometimes known as the Hopkins Report, exposing vulnerabilities in Diebold machines. Diebold machines were used for the entire state of Georgia in 2002. Everyone thought they were really great. They've got this wonderful videotape I saw when they were one of the contestants for the Santa Clara County machines, where they show all the happy people in Georgia voting on Diebold machines and saying, oh, wow, this is so great, this is so cool, this is wonderful, it's so easy to use. Bev will talk, I expect, about Rob Georgia, right? We'll talk about that. But basically, there were a couple of upsets in Georgia. Max Cleland, who was the Democratic senator from Georgia, lost in a very, very tight race, where prior to the election he had been favored to win. Now, he may very well have lost. I'm not saying that there was any hanky-panky that went on there, but the problem is you don't know. That's the real problem. You don't know. You don't know if he lost or if he didn't lose, and that also creates problems for the person who was elected, or at least presumably elected. Did that person deserve to be elected? And I think in the long run, it's going to create a lot of voter cynicism. So one of the complaints that one of the objections that people direct our way is that we are, basically scaring people. Either that or we're Luddites. That's another one that frequently gets thrown at the computer scientists. Now, it's unfortunate we have to scare people, but I think this is really pretty damn serious, because what we're talking about is the integrity of our elections. And if we don't get it right, if we have a situation where the voters start really wondering, was this person truly elected, or was there a problem with the machines? When you get to that kind of situation, the voter cynicism that we've seen up till now will be nothing compared to what we'll have. So continuing on with, I'm skipping over Diebold here. Oh, okay, yeah, there was another cute thing about Diebold I'll just mention quickly, and that is that some of the internal emails were obtained and posted on the internet, and so Diebold started going after some of the people who posted it, including a number of Swarthmore undergraduates. They were among the first. And they went after them, again, using the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. So what they said was, because these emails were quite embarrassing, talking about all the kludges that they had and trying to fix this and fix that and these problems and that problems, Diebold said, these are not our emails, but you may not post them because we have the copyright. They said that. Okay, so I think I'll talk very briefly about testing and security. And this is a problem with both internet voting and DRE voting. Testing is a major issue. There's this generic problem with using computers for voting, and that is you've got a hard deadline. And that's something I think any computer scientist, any computer person can relate to. You've got a hard deadline. So if you find bugs in the software, or if there are bug fixes sent out for some of the commercial software that you're using in your program, and you put them in, you don't put them in, every time you make a change, you're supposed to get your software recertified, and you're also supposed to test it, of course. So there's an independent testing authority. There are independent testing authorities, three of them that do the testing. They're also secret. The tests are secret. The results are secret. But you've got to get things tested and certified by the deadline. So you've got some real hard deadlines here. One of the things that came out recently was that none of the Diebold machines being used in California was certified. None of them. Which got the Secretary of State kind of annoyed. And the newspaper article that I held up here was basically saying that he has now demanded that Diebold turn over their software for inspection by an independent panel of technical people. We'll see what happens with that. But this testing does not do testing the way computer scientists think of testing. They do not do a code review. They look at the code. They don't look at the commercial code. They don't look at the COTS code. They're not allowed to look at that. They just take it on faith that it's correct. But they look at the other code. Yeah? Sorry? Oh, sorry. So they look at the other code, and they test it for things like, are there enough comments? Are the command lines too long? Are subroutines single entry, single exit? They don't do serious logic tests. They may do some logic testing, but they do not do code review for two reasons. I mean, at least for one reason, because it's very time-consuming and very expensive to do a code review. And they don't do them. What they do exactly, we're not sure. I mean, what I've told you is what I've been told, but exactly what they do, I don't know. And one of the reasons that you can believe that they don't do adequate testing is that there have been all these exposés for Diebold, where basically the Hopkins people and then the subsequent testing found all kinds of flaws in the code. Even the SAI, I mean, all the tests that have been done on Diebold have found serious flaws in the code. There's one other issue with testing, and that is if you are going to test for election code, you're going to test for the most obvious kinds of problems, right? I mean, you look for the most obvious kinds of problems. But if you're going to put malicious code into a machine, you're not going to make it obvious. You're going to make it very subtle. And that's going to be even harder to detect. So on the one hand, I'm saying testing is an impossible problem because it's very hard to find the malicious code. It's like trying to find a needle in a haystack. On the other hand, what I'm saying is the testing that does exist is really inadequate, seriously inadequate. So I should probably finish because I've been told I'm out of time. So let me just make one quick comment, and I apologize for the fact that I'm jumping all over the place because my head's really in internet voting. There is something going on in Michigan which you may know about. The Michigan Democratic Party is currently holding its caucuses, and they are allowing people to vote over the internet. There are three ways you can vote in Michigan. You can vote in the precincts on Saturday, on the 7th, on the day that they're holding them. You can do mail absentee ballots, or you can vote on the internet. The internet voting is going on right now. And when the serve report cancellation was announced, I just spoke with a reporter earlier this afternoon who was able to get through the Michigan Democratic Party, and she told me that their response is, well, yes, but we have a secure system, unlike the one that the DOD had. So I would be happy to elaborate further on that, because I know something about the Michigan system, having made an attempt to get it stopped. An 11th hour attempt when I was invited to testify before the Democratic National Committee on it, but that's another story. The two of us had only 15 minutes altogether to testify, so it was too late. I think I'll stop there, but and as I say, I apologize for being so scattered. It's that this has been a really amazing couple of days.